Petro Trelawney will have the unenviable task of keeping everything in order for Radio 3, though perhaps sadly without the help of a sonic screwdriver. So that's The Prom next Saturday night, starting at 7:30. This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, and on digital radio, 1 o'clock the time, and that means the news from Vaughan Savage.
At least 43 people have been killed in a suicide bombing near the Iraqi capital Baghdad. Another 40 were injured in the attack, which targeted Sawar militiamen queuing for their wages. Three other people died in a second suicide attack on a Sawar office near the Syrian border. The pro-government militia, recruited mainly from Sunni Arab tribesmen, is credited with turning the tide in the war against Al-Qaeda in Iraq. A suicide bomb blast aimed at a convoy of foreign troops in the Afghan capital Kabul has killed at least three civilians. Security in the city had been stepped up 2 days before the city is due to host an international conference on Afghanistan's future. Up to 70 foreign ministers, including the US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, are due to attend the gathering. The British government is planning to boost spending on aid projects in Afghanistan by 40% as part of the strategy for the handover of security control to Afghan forces. Some of the Britons holidaying abroad with the collapsed tour operator Gold Trail say they're facing demands for extra payments from hotels. The Civil Aviation Authority says it's making good progress in arranging flights home for 16,000 customers of the Surrey-based firm, which went into administration on Friday. Nelson Mandela is celebrating his 92nd birthday. The occasion is being marked worldwide for the first time as Nelson Mandela International Day. A 40-mile stretch of one of Europe's busiest motorways, the Autobahn between Dortmund and Duisburg, is closed today for a giant street festival. The route is lined with what the organisers claim is the world's longest table, showcasing hobbies, clubs and bands. Among participants from across Europe, as well as the US and Japan, is a brass combo called Tuba Libre. The weather: rain will give way to sunny spells in Scotland, especially in the east. Outbreaks of rain and drizzle will persist, though, in northern England, Wales and Northern Ireland. It'll be largely dry and bright across England this afternoon. The BBC News and Weather at 1:02 past 1.
And now this weekend's second instalment of the Early Music Show, presented by Catherine Bott.
Vivo. O precious sighs, O beloved torment, do not rob me of your wounds, which render sweet both death and life. Collegium Vocale Köln, singing from the fifth book of madrigals by Carlo Gesualdo, an Italian composer who lived one of the most dramatic lives of the 16th century, a murderer, manic depressive, a musical mannerist who was torn between the forces of life and a pathological yearning for death. This year marks the 400th anniversary of the death of an equally turbulent artist, whose wealthy patron even described as a man with a very odd brain. Michelangelo Merisi da Caravaggio used street children and prostitutes as models for the saints and sinners of his paintings, and he walked the streets of Rome with an armed servant boy to protect him from his low-life enemies. He lived and worked in chiaroscuro, dramatic contrasts of light and shade. In the 19th century, John Ruskin numbered Caravaggio among the worshippers of the depraved, and it wasn't until the 1950s that his work was rediscovered. There's still a danger that the sensational details of his short life can overshadow the marvels of his paintings. A few days ago, I had the pleasure of talking to an expert about Caravaggio's artistic legacy and some of the music that features in his paintings. The critic and presenter of TV's The Culture Show, Andrew Graham Dixon, has written an acclaimed biography, Caravaggio, A Life Sacred and Profane, which takes us through the painter's turbulent life in context with each work as he painted it. I asked Andrew Graham Dixon, what is it about Caravaggio that makes him so pertinent today, 400 years after his death?
In a sense, he's the perfect artist for an age obsessed by celebrity because he ticks all the boxes and he's outrageous in his personal behaviour, and he kills a man, possibly while attempting to castrate him. He has sex with all kinds of people, the wrong kinds of people, prostitutes, young men, and he has this incredible life, and it's a tragic life, it's a very sad life. You know, he loses almost his entire male family when he's aged 5 to the plague in Milan, which I think explains a lot about him. I think he feels from the beginning, he feels as a sense of that he's been betrayed by God. He's been picked out, singled out for this terrible destiny. He seems to have been volatile from the start. He can't settle into any relationship. In his art, he's capable of this huge, extraordinary compassion and tenderness. The late Adoration in Messina is just, for me, one of the most moving paintings in the whole world. I mean, it's a painting about Mary and Jesus, but it's really a painting about refugees. It's a painting about this is the way that life is. You know, there will always be people in this predicament, abandoned by everybody. You know? And he feels, because he has suffered himself, he's got such a well of compassion and feeling. He's at his best as a person, as a human being. In his art, he's extraordinary.
The motet O Vos Omnes by Carlo Gesualdo. All ye who pass by on your way, hearken and behold, if there be any grief as my grief. It was sung on that recording by the Monteverdi Choir, conducted by John Elliot Gardiner. On today's programme, I'm talking to Andrew Graham Dixon about the life and works of Gesualdo's near-contemporary Caravaggio. When we met recently, I asked what he thought about the frequent coupling of Caravaggio's name with that late Renaissance buzzword, mannerism.
I think Caravaggio is the antithesis of a mannerist, he's the opposite of a mannerist. He comes to Rome in early 1590s. Michelangelo is dead. Titian is dead. Italian painting is in the doldrums. What we've got is a late, exhausted form of mannerism, which is the art of visual cleverness. You arrange lots and lots of figures in contrived and complicated poses. It's rather heartless. It's highly artificial. And Caravaggio actually is the artist who puts a stop to it. And what he does is he goes back to the most powerful strains of popular Italian art, which can be found both in genuinely popular, almost fairground-type art, certain types of terracotta sculpture that you find in northern Italy, Sacro Monte, which are these mountains where people used to go on pilgrimage, and they'd go to these chapels, which would be arranged almost like waxwork figures enacting terrible things like the Massacre of the Innocents. Very, very immediate, vital, brutal, bloody. And in high art, that also means going back to someone like Donatello, at the absolute sort of peak point of early Renaissance art in Florence in the 1430s, 1440s, is creating these incredibly realistic images of Mary Magdalene or John the Baptist. That's what Caravaggio goes back to. He's going back to an art that talks directly to people about religious experience. Mannerism out the window. And he sets his face against the Baroque, because there's an argument going on within the church in Caravaggio's time, is who is Christianity for? Is Christianity for the poor people? Or is Christianity actually a way whereby we, the princes of the church, can control the poor? And the Baroque is the style of control. The Baroque turns the church into a huge image of a palace, and it's very hierarchical. You've got the priest enacting mass, you've got the people down here, you've got this huge church that's like a palace. And what that style of art does, paintings filled with fricassees of cherubim, wafting people's souls to heaven, highly theatrical, that tells the poor, right, your place is down there. Caravaggio comes in and he's absolutely not Baroque and he's absolutely not mannerist. What he does is he puts ordinary people in with dirty feet. He reminds us that Christianity is of and for the poor, that Christ was poor, that his pilgrims are poor. And that's why he gets into a lot of trouble. On the one hand, it works. The masses come, they go to church, they worship. But on the other hand, it's preaching a message that's, in a way, it's against the Pope and his cardinals and the bishops. It's against the grandeur of the church.
Oh.
Music from a work from the year of Caravaggio's death, Monteverdi's Vespers of 1610. The performers, blending the grandeur of the church with the iconoclastic intimacy of single voices, were members of the New London Consort, directed by Philip Pickett. As I mentioned earlier, Andrew Graham Dixon and I wanted to look in detail at some of Caravaggio's most musical paintings. I began by asking him about what I've always perceived as the rather claustrophobic atmosphere in The Musicians. Four beautiful young men looking right out at you from the canvas. It's rather unsettling.
This is a painting that spawned a thousand fantasies. I mean, this painting was responsible, I think, for Derek Jarman's dreadful but interesting to look at film about Caravaggio. But you can kind of see, you know, you've got four boys in an Ellis interior, and one of them has got his drapery falling off his shoulder. You can see Derek Jarman sort of developed this idea that Cardinal Del Monte's palace, where Caravaggio first found a home, where he painted this picture for Cardinal Del Monte. This sort of fantasy that Cardinal Del Monte was this louche, gay cardinal, filled his house up with beautiful young boys and invited connoisseurs like Galileo to come, and they were all, you know, ogling and, you know, this sort of rather sticky fantasy. It's not the truth. Cardinal Del Monte was fascinated by music. He was in charge of the papal choir. He engaged in these new experiments of music, these concerts where people would sing and you would listen to one person's voice and it would be very, very beautiful. And what Caravaggio has done here, he's painted this picture for Del Monte's Camerino, which is a room dedicated to music, which we know, because we've got the inventories of Cardinal Del Monte's house, contained guitars and musical instruments. It was where he would stage concerts for his fellow cardinals and friends. I think it's a compliment to Del Monte, in a sense, this picture, because what he's done is he's shown us, it's unlike any other concert picture, they're not actually playing their instruments, they're not singing, they're getting ready. There's a boy with angel's wings that he hasn't quite strapped them on properly, and there's about to be a theatrical performance. And I think the conceit of the painting is that they're waiting for Cardinal Del Monte to arrive, and he's then going to direct their activities, and a concert will ensue.
Well, you can imagine, I mean, lots of overinterpretation going into the central boy's right hand on the lute. It seems to me that this isn't a late 16th century fingering technique. He's just holding it. That's the way of holding it in place.
Yeah, they're not playing. I mean, look, he hasn't got his drapery ready, and, you know, another boy is still learning his part. He's looking at
his
part.
He must be the singer. They're always the last.
It's a fascinating picture. I mean, he's arranged the figures rather like a classical frieze. It's very sort of pushed up to the front of the canvas. It's got a slightly claustrophobic feeling about it.
And there is a feeling there's this mess of music with a violin resting on top of it in the foreground. And between bare legs, they're all hugger-mugger, rather like a crowded tube train in a way.
But you see, there's no implication. When Caravaggio wants to imply eroticism or sexual contact, it's unambiguous. This is not a painting about sex and eros for me. It just isn't. It's a picture of some boys who are about to play a concert for a man who's a kind of a musical revolutionary, Del Monte. I hadn't realised, and he assisted at the birth of opera, because one of his closest friends maybe didn't write what's considered to be the first opera, Emilio de Cavalieri.
Voi, ascoltando stavi, perché non giuni là? Tutti gli pien gioiosi con festa giubiliamo, con giubilo cantiamo, fugga il lontano e il lutto, festa, 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 festa per tutto.
Grazie, Dio.
Magnificat and The Whole Noise, directed by Warren Stewart and Susan Harvey, combining in that rousing climax, which ends Act 3 of Emilio de Cavalieri's Rappresentazione di Anima e di Corpo, the representation of spirit and body, which is thought to be the earliest surviving entertainment set entirely to music, so it's a forerunner to both opera and oratorio, if you like. As we heard earlier, Cavalieri was befriended and encouraged by Cardinal Del Monte, a connoisseur of music and patron of the arts, who also gave Caravaggio his first big break as a painter. Caravaggio is the subject of today's Early Music Show, and my guest is art critic and writer Andrew Graham Dixon, who joined me in the studio a few days ago to talk about the musical references in some of Caravaggio's most famous paintings. When Caravaggio painted The Lute Player in about 1596, the musical revolutionaries of the time were composers like Cavalieri, Caccini and Monteverdi, the inspirations for what we now call the Baroque, although of course they didn't then. It was the human voice as an instrument that held the biggest fascination for these composers, and the importance of the solo singer is captured beautifully here. So it's a boy with lips slightly parted, not doing the full operatic roar, from which I think we can infer that he is singing or about to sing. He's gazing, again, very directly at us, and holding a lute. This time, the hands are much more in a playing position, and in front of him on the table, we have a violin, a little portative keyboard instrument, and a recorder, and, most importantly of all, some identifiable music.
Mm.
Now, Andrew, you have a theory about who this lute player and singer is, don't you?
Yes, I mean, I think there's a very good chance that this is Pedro de Montoya, who was a castrato who was given house room by Cardinal Del Monte. Cardinal Del Monte was very interested in this new expressive form of singing called the stile rappresentativo, and it very much focused on the solo voice, singing identifiably romantic, wistful, perhaps melancholic music designed to touch the heart. And castrati were particularly highly regarded as the types of singer who could carry this music. The reason I think it could well be Pedro Montoya is because he's got this slightly mumpish face. Slightly swollen cheeks are, I gather, having taken advice, one of the hormonal side effects of if you've been castrated. So there's a very chance that he's a castrato. And, quite pointedly, there are two part books on the table. One of them is shut and the other one is open. So the open one obviously contains the music that I hope we'll listen to. But the other one is prominently marked bassus. In other words, it's a way of Caravaggio saying, well, he's never going to hit the low notes. The bassus part book is shut.
This is a closed book to him.
Yeah, yes. Exactly.
Now, one thing that really interests me is that in front of him is this open piece of music, which can be identified.
Mm.
And this is a piece called Chi potrà dir, about light and shade falling on the beautiful lady's face and all that sort of thing.
Mm.
But it's very archaic. It's by Arkadelt. And Arkadelt was working at the very beginning of the 16th century. So this is quite anachronistic. It's early music in a time when really people concentrated always on the immediate, the new. How symbolic is that,
well,
this old piece of music?
My understanding is that they were returning to that music because it suited their new preconceptions. So in a sense it's archaic, but in another sense they're probably singing it in a way that Arkadelt himself would never have heard it sung. It's being sung in a way that places so much emphasis on the emotions that it embodies that it struck people at the time as something really quite new. And we've got an account, in fact, of a singer, a female singer, called Vittoria Archilei, singing one day at the house of Cardinal Del Monte, his country house, not his palace in the centre of Rome. And she sang in a high-vaulted room, and a cardinal is writing and saying, it reduced them to tears. They could not believe that somebody could sing like this.
Oh,
to go with the light and shade, the chiaroscuro that can be found in every one of Caravaggio's portraits. That was the very piece of music that's shown in this painting of the lute player, Arkadelt's Chi potrà dir, a song about the play of light and shade on the poet's mistress's face. And in that recording, made specially for us here at the Early Music Show, the singer was Robin Blaise, with lutenist Elizabeth Kenny. You're listening to The Early Music Show with me, Catherine Bott, and on today's programme, I'm metaphorically sitting at the feet of the art critic and broadcaster Andrew Graham Dixon, whose fascinating new biography of Caravaggio is out now. Caravaggio lived in an intensely religious climate, of course, but I asked Andrew, given the raffish lifestyle of the painter and the almost terrifying sensuality of the religious paintings he created, whether he was actually a fervent believer himself.
I think there is some doubt about whether he was a fervent believer. I think he was a slightly schizophrenic believer myself. He paints the ideas of Christianity with incredible depth and humanity. I mean, there are sort of little hints and suggestions that he became rather dark. I mean, he's offered holy water from a stoup in a church in Sicily. And he says, what's that for? And they say, it's to wash away your venial sins. And he says, oh, it's no point giving that to me. It's all my sins are mortal. So it's very, very dark. I think he wavers between reaching, you know, for the light, reaching for salvation, and feeling that it's not possible. And perhaps at the centre, at the heart of any faith, really, is that maybe it's none of it's true. In the darkest darkness of Caravaggio's paintures, I think there is that.
Can we talk for a moment about the religious art climate in which he was operating? I was very interested, right at the beginning of your book, you write about Cardinal Borromeo, who was obviously very proscriptive in his rules about what shouldn't be put on the canvas or in the fresco in religious art.
Yeah, well, remember, Caravaggio himself later in life seeks to join the Order of St. John. He wants to become a knight of God. This is a terrorist organisation who goes out across the Muslim world, killing and kidnapping and taking slaves. Caravaggio actually becomes part of that. You know, there's a sense that Christianity is in a real crisis. Post-Reformation period, in Rome you've got the Counter-Reformation, and in Milan, Carlo Borromeo has this absolutely profoundly strong belief that the church needs to clean up its act. It's got to get its act together. You know, so no more corruption, no more men and women looking at each other in churches. I mean, he erects screens between men and women. Caravaggio's brought up with that. And I think that's why he looks with so intensely. And Borromeo thinks that the whole world is almost an arena for religious experiment. He tries to ban carnival. He tries to ban theatre. Cancel Christmas, yeah. I mean, there's revolution in the streets in Milan. Even he realises that the Milanese can't be made to be totally, totally pure and perfect. This is the very, very extreme atmosphere in which Caravaggio is brought up.
Well, the Counter-Reformation, as it applied to music, one of the things that happened in church music, at any rate, was that there was a sort of fundamentalist back-to-basics movement to simplify the way text was offered so that it was purer, plainer, more easy to understand.
Yeah, the meaning gets through to the people who are supposed to be believing in God. I mean, it's as simple as that. And Caravaggio does that. Caravaggio is the great simplifier of Western art. I mean, that's what he does.
Well, Caravaggio wasn't the only artist who had a talent for simplification in a good cause. Palestrina was a composer who began his working life surrounded by the floridity, the panoply of religious expression in music of the Catholic Church. And then, after the Counter-Reformation, the Council of Trent, he then rethought his whole compositional method and went back to basics, you might say. So very tellingly, as we've been discussing Caravaggio's commitment to faith, here is the credo, I believe in God, from Palestrina's Missa Brevis. The performers are the Talis scholars, directed by Peter Phillips.
Credo. Thank you.
Well, the last painting we're going to look at, Andrew Graham Dixon and I, is another great mixture of light and dark. It's a very pale boy with very dark wings.
Mm.
And it is an extremely direct, full-frontal Cupid. There are musical instruments and pieces of music dotted about, but he's in the history of art because he's such a challenging figure.
I think I've worked out what this picture is all about. We're looking at Cupid, and as an early inventory says, Cupid is despising the world. The picture is called Amor Vincit Omnia, which is a Latin phrase meaning love conquers all. And Cupid triumphs over armour, symbolising the military aspirations of man, a set square, symbolising architecture, musical instruments and a part book, symbolising simultaneously, I think, music and mathematics with which music was connected. On the table next to him, there's a sceptre and a crown, indicating love conquers, no matter what man does, no matter what he aspires to, no matter what great books he might write. When love comes on the scene, all of that goes out the window because love conquers all. Now, interestingly, we know that Vincenzo Giustiniani, the immensely rich patron for whom Caravaggio painted this picture, kept it behind a green curtain. And when he took you round his house, if you were privileged enough to be taken around his house, he would take you to everything else. And then this was the pièce de résistance. This was the last thing he'd see, and he'd open the curtains. And you'd see this smiling, strange adolescent boy almost leering out at you. And I think if you look at the picture carefully, you'll see that it's full of Vs. The wings form a V. The set square forms a V. The boy's legs form an inverted V.
The angle of the arrows that he's gripping so firmly form a V against his
another V.
Body.
And Amor Vincit Omnia was a subject that you would paint if somebody in a family was about to get married. It's in a tradition of Italian paintings of Cupid conquering all, which they're almost like wishes for fertility for the future, and bring more Giustiniani into the world. And Vincenzo was the name of the patron, but Vincenzo was also the family name of the Giustiniani. It was the name that they kept giving. If you look closely, everything in the picture is actually having sex. The objects are actually copulating, if I can use that word. The crown is copulating with the sceptre. The musical instruments are engaged in congress. The set square is penetrating the furled curve of the part book. There's sex going on all over this picture. And the Renaissance and the 17th century were not squeamish about this sort of thing. But it's sex, it's real sex. What this picture is saying, yes, love conquers all. It's essentially it's saying, long live the Giustiniani. Long may they procreate.
And I'll get it.
One last thing that I can tell you about this picture, which adds another little frisson to it, is that an English bloke, Arthur Symonds, went to the Giustiniani Palace in about the 1650s. And as was the way, you know, the custode, the talkative chap who takes you round as a servant of the Giustiniani family, who tells you juicy stories about the pictures in the hope of a good tip, he tells this English bloke, Symonds, you know, gives him a little nudge, because Symonds writes it in his diary. This was the boy called Cecco del Caravaggio, which was indeed the name of Caravaggio's studio assistant, with whom Caravaggio lived after he moved out of Del Monte's house. He said, "This is Cecco. He was his boy, and he laid with him, he slept with him." So, 50 years later, the story was still current in Rome that this boy was one of Caravaggio's male lovers. You know, which is, as it were, another level to
it's not us he's looking at, is it? It's Caravaggio.
He's looking at Caravaggio as Caravaggio paints him. He's smiling, this sort of slightly disconcerting smile.
Any other viewer of this painting is not important, it seems to me. That look is for the artist.
It might be. I mean, Cecco did stay with him for quite a long time, but as I say, the interesting thing about Caravaggio when it comes to his sexuality is not, I feel, whether he was, in quotes, homosexual. It's the fact that he never settled with anybody. I mean, we know he had sex with women. I think I've found evidence to suggest that he may even have actually ran a small gang of prostitutes, as well as being a painter. It makes a lot of sense. The fact that Caravaggio is always out late at night in Rome with a sword, and he's always frequenting the houses of prostitutes.
Some of whom he paints.
Some of whom he
That's
paints.
A so useful it's a, source of,
well,
of beauty.
Well, it's hard to get models. To
a sit useful
to
source of willing beauty.
And remember, the man he kills was himself a pimp. And had been the pimp of Caravaggio's favourite model. And we know that Caravaggio took her, so to speak, from him. So I sort of wonder whether it's not possible that there was actually an argument about business. That's what I love about Caravaggio's paintings, is that you see Filo de Melandroni, his favourite whore, as St. Catherine, and there's this extraordinary double take. Yes, she's St. Catherine. She's fantastically convincing St. Catherine. She really wants to die the martyr's death. She caresses the sword. But she's also Phillida in a room with Caravaggio, and you can feel the relationship between the two people. It's still there. that somehow this picture, as you say, that is Checo looking at Caravaggio forever, and it sends a shiver down your spine. It's like being Caravaggio looking at it. See, people get more disturbed by it than they should. I think it's a rather joyful, you know, it's like it's... once you see it as joyful rather than sinister.
I think the only thing that gives it a sinister appearance is actually the face of the boy, who looks as if he'd probably mug you.
Slightly unsettling. I mean, yeah, he is a bit of an angel with a dirty face, isn't he? I mean, he's streetwise.
Would you have wanted this as a wedding present?
Well, it makes you think, why did he keep it behind green curtains? Was it too disturbing to have it looking at you all the time?
I think maybe so.
Yeah, and that's a good point.
Soprano Montserrat Figueras and lutenist Hopkinson Smith with Amor Io Parto from Caccini's pioneering collection of songs Le Nuove Musiche, literally The New Musics. And Caravaggio's art is also eternally new, whether he's offering us the everlasting triumph of love or a tribute to the power of music. His late Renaissance genius can teach modern cinematographers a thing or two. My thanks to Andrew Graham Dixon for sharing his expertise and himself proving such a learned and voluble custode of Caravaggio's reputation.
Today's Early Music Show was presented by Catherine Bott and produced in Manchester by Les Pratt. Well, there'll be no Early Music Show next Sunday as we'll be at the WOMAD Festival, but on Saturday's programme, Lucy Skeeping will be talking to Ka Ming Ng from the ensemble Charivari Agréable, and they'll be talking about the recent release of their new CD with the King Singers of Pachelbel's Vespers. That's at the usual time, just after the 1 o'clock news.
A Beethoven night at the Proms. Join Radio 3 on Wednesday evening as renowned pianist Paul Lewis launches his complete cycle of piano concertos, with the exuberant first and intense and introspective fourth. He's partnered by Jerzy Bielochlawek, conducting the BBC Symphony Orchestra in a concert with more Beethovenian drama from two of the composer's heroic overtures. Join me, Katie Derham, as the BBC Proms 2010 continue with Paul Lewis playing Beethoven this Wednesday evening at 7 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3.
And now here's Chichi Nwanaku with 2 hours of your Radio 3 requests.
Thank you. And I'll start by granting Mr. T. Lloyd in Reading his wish. I heard on a BBC Radio 3 request programme a piece recorded at the Proms that has stayed in the memory, he tells us. It was a sound portrayal of a marching military band, the sound increasing in volume to represent the band getting closer and then gradually decreasing. I've tried to find that recording but have had no success. Could you help, please? I can, Mr. Lloyd, and here it is. marching off into the darkness from where it came, The Night Retreat of Madrid by Boccherini, arranged by Luciano Berio. The Milan Radio Symphony Orchestra was conducted by Riccardo Chailly. A wish fulfilled, I hope, for Mr. Lloyd. Next, Brooding List, a piano work he wrote during a pilgrimage through Switzerland and Italy with his mistress, Countess Marie Dagou. Liszt was fired up by a 14th century love sonnet, Sonnet 104 by Petrarch, and I imagine the glorious Alpine landscape also played a part.